that's where we're going to keep our focus.
So you're not answering, you won't answer that question.
I did. I just did.
Yes or no?
No, you want to. No, if you want to continue to engage in finger pointing and blame gaming, that's fine. We're going to engage. It's not ridiculous.
Don't try to accuse me of that. I'm asking a direct question and you should answer it. Does he retain complete confidence in his...
Like I said, you're... Exactly, is what you're engaging in.
Yes or no?
And absolutely.
I'm not engaging in anything. I'm
absolutely.
Question about what the president is
absolutely.
Doing.
We appreciate...
substantial criticism of members of his administration, okay? And you know that, and everybody watching...
No. No, everybody that watches this knows, David, that you're trying to engage in a blame game.
I am trying to engage.
Yes.
I am trying to engage.
That's correct.
That's a dodge. I have a follow-up question since you dodged that one. Does the White House feel like it missed opportunities to alleviate or head off some of the damage in the New Orleans area, flood damage? Did it miss an opportunity to head any of that off?
In what way?
In responding to requests to make structural improvements or other improvements to alleviate flood damage.
Maybe you ought to look at what General Strzok said, because General Strzok briefed on this the other day, and he talked about the design issues relating to the levees and how that was a design issue, and he talked about that. We provided, I think it was some $300 million in the
never stop. Now you got your little talking points memo. And what's the code word today? Blame game. Just keep throwing that out. So Boy George saying, I don't want to play a blame game. You, Scott, you're trying to talk this blame game nonsense. The corporatists in New Orleans are just saying, let's just rebuild. Let's not get caught up in a blame game. Yet at the same time, if you say don't play a blame game and let's not finger point, you point the finger at the poor and the black and say it's their own fault that they died in New Orleans. Well, while you're finger pointing, it's time we start pointing something else. Right at, well, I think you know what I mean. And then you have the nerve also to go ahead and not know what this little report is talking about when he's saying that, could this administration have headed off the damage? Look, the reality is capitalism is damaged in every sense. Profits of this world. That's what they are. Listening to 103.3, 104.1 in Berkeley, 101.1 with Skidmark in Santa Cruz, 107.5 North Carolina, 106.7 Illinois, Uprising Radio, LUVER.com, the world, RadioBroad.net, the universe, and click into the slave web. Go Google Slave Revolt Radio, find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going beyond the shadows to deal with the concepts of what these prophets and profits are up to in this misery and doom segment. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
installment of the Hurricane Sam series. We're going to deal with the systematic process of capitalist profit-making at human and planetary expense, where many human beings are trying to help reconstruct the shattered lives of many of the Hurricane Sam victims, the merchants of death in this capitalist order see a way of expanding the blood-soaked profits for themselves. And as we will see, this corporate order is based in the profits of misery. They are the prophets of doom. First, let's go into what Potop Chattery has to say. He's a part of Corp Watch. And here he outlines what is going on with some of the connections with these profiteers of misery and how they are settling their hooves in not only the soil of New Orleans in the form of reconstruction, but into the souls of the peoples right as we speak.
Variety of things that are being fixed here, one of which is the levees, clearly, and we've seen, you know, the dramatic television footage of them dropping sandbags into the hole. There's the removal of the debris, there's the reconstruction of the buildings, and there's also the reconstruction of the Navy facilities and the seaports and that sort of thing. And that's where Halliburton has its contract. It's not actually in the reconstruction of the levees or the clearing of the debris. So, for example, the debris is being cleared in Mississippi and Alabama by, there's a company called Ash Britt, and there's another company called Phillips and Jordan, and they're specialists in going in after prior hurricanes and cleaning up debris. FEMA is paying for that. And then you have companies that actually construct levees, and in this particular case, the famous 17th Street Canal that collapsed is being fixed by a company called Bow Brothers. And there are other companies like HNTB, and the reasons I'm mentioning the sort of jumble of names, which I'll come to in a second. But basically, Bow Brothers, just about a year ago, had no money. They were in charge of this reconstruction, and they had no money because their funding was cut. And they get their money from the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers pays for, you know, the fixing of the levees and that sort of thing. And of course, they get their money from the administration and Congress and the White House.
So you see how this whole game works. Here you have, like, as Potop was saying, Bow Brothers, who are paid by the Army of Engineers, but they're defunded by Boy George's administration in part to expand its empire over oil resources in Iraq. So they end up being involved in using money, taxpayer money, in destroying Iraq. These same types of people, the Halliburton types and all of that, end up getting contracts in places in Iraq to reconstruct Iraq. Meanwhile, the infrastructure collapses here, connected to the way that the industry is designed, its whole profiteering mode, its collapsing of the wetlands, its destruction of the Mississippi, in the way that, you know, there's a particular type of wall, and there's like an I wall and a T wall, something like that. And one, they decided to use the cheap model. One of the I walls versus the T walls is a much better wall and could sustain itself to a much higher resistance. But they displayed on the cheap. I mean, after all, it's just human beings' lives, disposable human beings. And even if it does collapse, these same corporate forces will come in and profit off of that. They profit off of people's misery. So, here, the Bow Brothers, who were defunded through the Army of Engineers because of the, in part, imperialist war in Iraq, end up profiteering off of the fact that the collapse happened that was connected to them taking money out of the infrastructure protections within that region of the country. See, this is not based on a sustainable mode that the capitalist empire, the capitalist order is on. And you heard them talk about, you know, Ash Britt and all of these guys, Phillips and Jordan, and they're involved in this removal of debris and all of that. Now look how they scattered the people all throughout the countryside, basically to disconnect them from participating in the reconstruction of their own lives, and so that they will not have as strong of an impact in a say of what goes on in the reconstruction of New Orleans. So once again, these profiteers of misery and these prophets of doom just know no bounds. Now next, Protop goes into how the Army Corps of Engineers complain about the defunding, but at the same time, we know that there's no real opposition because they're part of the system. So this is how it played out. Check it out.
The people on the ground, Al Naomi was the guy in charge of this, and he you know, bitterly opposed the cutting of these funds. So he said, we really, really need this money. We need to pay Bow Brothers and C.R. Pittman and all the other companies on the ground that were doing this work. This is long before Katrina and for years before. And they had, you know, they had consultants and political lobbyists like Bennett Johnston, who's the former Democratic senator from Louisiana, working the hill for them, trying to get this money, and they didn't get it. Because clearly the administration and Congress between them, who make decisions on these matters, decided there were more important priorities. Now what's interesting, and this is a question that I haven't been able to answer, and I'm trying to figure out right now, but it is the chain of command within the Army Corps of Engineers, the people that present the options to the president as to what to pay for and what not to pay for. And what's interesting is the same men that were in charge of presenting options in Louisiana and doing that construction were the people who were in charge of Iraq reconstruction. And we know that the money that was cut from levy, fixing the levies in New Orleans and Louisiana actually went to Iraq by virtue of reporting that was done by the Times-Picayune, where people complained that they had been told by the administration they needed the money, they needed to cut somewhere, and that money was going to Iraq. So that's what we understand is how it happened. So what I'm trying to get to is the core of the matter is who was involved, who made those decisions. And what's very interesting is a few pictures and evidence that I found. One is of a gentleman by the name of Lieutenant General Carl Strock. And Carl Strock is the guy who's in charge of the Army Corps of Engineers. He's the commander. And the man below him is a guy called Brigadier General Robert Creer. He's the guy in charge of the Mississippi. These are the two most powerful men in the Army Corps of Engineers. And I have pictures of them in Louisiana from this year where they're shaking hands with the governor of Louisiana and talking about how they're going to protect the wetlands and that sort of thing. But I also have pictures of them 2 years ago in southern Iraq where they were overseeing the putting out of the oil fires and repairing of the pipelines. Now, the company that had that contract was Halliburton, which now actually has the most lucrative contract in Louisiana, which is the fixing of the Navy facilities, and that's a $500 million contract. And what's even more interesting is that Carl Strock is the man who demoted the whistleblower who, about 3 weeks ago, who complained that Halliburton got a no-bid contract. Her name is Bunny Greenhouse. So Bunny Greenhouse was the woman who said, this is wrong, this is illegal, you cannot give a no-bid contract to Halliburton to go work in Iraq to repair the pipelines. So she was demoted by Karl Strauch, the man who is currently in charge of the Army Corps of Engineers and therefore negotiates with the White House and helps them figure out what they want. Now, he may have argued mightily in favor of the engineering, but at some point the administration said, you're going to have to cut something. What are you going to... And these are the questions.
Once again, see how corrupt this whole process is and how it's all based off of a profit mode and how these needs and call for profit take precedence over everything. So here you have Karl Strutt and his little partner, who are the same cats who were involved in the Iraq reconstruction. And the only reason why Iraq needs to be quote-unquote reconstructed is because imperialists, for its own imperialist grand chessboard needs, gains, and interests, have bombarded the land. So here they are engaged in the reconstruction of Iraq, and now they're in the forefront of being involved through Halliburton and other connections that they're connected with the so-called reconstruction of New Orleans. Yet at the same time, as Protop pointed out, it became clear that with the particular quandary and economic crisis that the U.S. capitalist system is in, and the way that it is willing to exploit and put in the crosshairs large numbers of its own citizens, this Levy became one of the casualties of it. This Levy system became one of the areas that ended up being defunded. As they told Boy George, you're going to have to make a cut somewhere. You're going to have to cut something. And it ended up being the Levy system. And the people who suffered were the masses of regular working folks, working class people in New Orleans. Yet, the people who benefit off of this misery are not the people who are now in some kind of shelter. They're not the people who are being eaten up by some crocodile. It's not some people who are rotting on the sidewalk in Algiers. It's the profiteers. It's the capitalists. This is how sick this system is. And this is how disconnected the machine is from any kind of real social human relation and compassion. It's all based off of profits. And then this Karl Strutt is the same guy who demoted the whistleblower, Bunny Greenhouse. She was the one who pointed out that these guys were just working in this no-bid contract mode, violating laws, just looting and just carrying on in every way imaginable. And for shining the spotlight on that, she gets demoted. Now, when people want to sensationalize aspects of what they consider black depravity, they're giving all the cameras and lenses in the world, you know, to go to some little shopping center and show a black person walking out of a store with a couple of pieces of bread. But when someone tries to shine the light on the corporate looting in its truly most vicious and vile form, demotion, at the very least, is what one can expect. Now, next, Protop goes into Robert Flowers. This is Strutt's former boss. So let's check out what he has to say about this. Check it out.
Karl Strutt's former boss, Robert B. Flowers, is the man who signed the contracts for Halliburton in person. And he was also the person who was in charge at the time they cut the funding. So Strzok was below him. So it's getting a little complicated. So again, to simplify it, Robert B. Flowers is the man who was the commander in charge of giving contracts to Halliburton during the reconstruction of Iraq. He was also the person who basically oversaw the agency when the funding was cut to levee reconstruction. What's interesting is he's retired now, and he now works for a company that builds, guess what, levees. HNTB. They also actually, they're a big engineering company. So here's the thing is, and to get to the bottom of this matter, and this is something that I'm researching right now, I want to know what Robert B. Flowers did. Why he right now is in charge of the federal unit. He's in charge of lobbying to get more federal money for his company so they can do things like the seismic retrofit of the Golden Gate Bridge, the building of the Bunker Hill Bridge in Boston. It's a new bridge. Now, that was before his time. One contract that he did get for them was a whole lot of work in Fort Leavenworth, which he once was a senior commander in. So that's the reason a lot of these engineering companies hire people from the military, is because they know how the system works, they know how to lobby and how to get contracts, you know, to pay for levee construction.
Now, once again, one can see how this vile and sick this whole thing is, and how it just laps over in contradiction and in extreme explicit barbarity. Here you have Flowers. Flowers is someone who's connected with the whole Imperial Military Order. He gets helped these corporations like Halliburton get contracts. He helps them get contracts in the Imperial War in Iraq. At the same time, he oversaw the Levy reconstruction cuts. So he's helping Halliburton get contracts in Iraq, where the funds are siphoned off from the Levy reconstruction works that were going on in New Orleans. The system in New Orleans collapses, and now this same person is a lobbyist for a Levy company. This is a self-perpetual thing going on, and as long as the winds of Hurricane Sam keep blowing over the lives of the expendable people, the masses of poor people, the masses of black people, the large majority of working class people, then that is something that is acceptable to these prophets of doom and these profiteers of misery. It can't be much clearer than that. But next here, Prochop goes into the demoted Halliburton worker, Bunny Greenwald, and some of the things that took place with her.
Halliburton got the contract from the Army Corps of Engineers to put out the oil fires and subsequently to truck the fuel, charging for the fuel that was brought from Kuwait and Turkey into Iraq. So on February 26, 2003, she sat in this meeting in the Pentagon, where she was given, drawing up a plan for how they would do this reconstruction. And the two people in the room who were helping draft those rules were two people from Halliburton. He said, well, this is wrong. First of all, the CFR, which is basically a army system of how contracts are handed out. These are the regulations, the CFR regulations. I think it's actually something, I forget exactly what it stands for, something federal regulation, basically say that a company that designs a project cannot bid on it. And Halliburton was actually given the job of designing how we would go in and reconstruct Iraq's pipelines and that sort of thing. And they were sitting there writing, not only simply planning it, but they were actually writing the contract that they were about to get without bidding. And so when Bunny Greenhouse walked into this meeting and her boss at the time, Carl Strock, was then negotiating with them, she said, this is completely illegal and wrong, and you need to get them to leave. So they left the meeting, but then Robert Flowers eventually sent her a task order, which she is the person in charge of procurement. She's sort of the bureaucrat who signs orders saying, okay, this can be given out to a private contractor. And she said, you know, I really don't think I should sign this. And they're like, well, you need to sign it. I'm sort of paraphrasing some. I don't know exactly what they said. But what she did, and she was very clever, that she wrote a little note in the margin, because the physical document that was signed in ink, you know, is the one that goes into the record. And she said, and this is unusual because people don't normally write notes in the margin saying, this should have been competitively bid. Again, I'm paraphrasing. And the only reason we know is because a journalist from Time magazine, Adam Zagrin, FOIA'd, got these documents under Freedom of Information, and he noticed that there was this note saying this is not been done the wrong way and this should have been competitively bid. So then he called the army and said, what's going on? And she decided to go public and tell people. And so 3 weeks ago, they demoted her. And the man who demoted her is the man you'll see on television now saying, we're doing all we can to help the people of Louisiana, to bring the story full circle.
And once again, to bring it full circle, it's also clear that, see, this is why, you know, I often say this is well beyond a Democrat-Republican issue. And why one cannot grovel within their ranks and think that you're somehow going to find a solution within the Democrat or Republican ranks. These guys are just administrators to this particular ruling order. So at best, they can play lip service, you know, and say, you know, oh, that's wrong. You know, Barbara Lee can get on there and denounce it, you know, on KPFA or whatever. But at the end of the day, they're part of the servant element to all of this profit over misery order, to this capitalist machine. And no matter what administration that you see in, this empire keeps getting stronger in its grips of totality over the basic lives and rights and basic transparency that any kind of halfway civilized society one would expect. Things are becoming less transparent, and it hasn't shown any element of vulnerability. That particular, this class, this ruling class, has not shown any element of vulnerability to its lack of transparency based on what particular party is in power. They are magnifying their boldness up day by day, month by month, year by year, administration by administration. Now, here you have basic draft rules that says that if you're a designer, which you get paid for, if you're a designer of a, you know, whatever project, you can't bid on it. So it wasn't like Halliburton didn't get paid already. They got paid for designing it. They're not doing nothing, you know. But then they want to bid on it at the same time. The hell with the rules. Now, a part of the reason why in a construction type of thing that they would want a separation from someone designing and bidding is because you can do a lot of manipulation if you're designing of a of a particular construction project. Then you can already tell your subcontractors beforehand that, look, give me prices that I'll appreciate, and I'll make sure that I'll write you into the spec as the only person that can bid on this project. So that way, you get substantial leverage and cuts and influence. And you don't have to be transparent about that to whoever you're giving your particular price to. It can be hidden murkiness and stuff. You can claim that it costs X amount for whatever product, but you can have them tell the people you're giving a price to give, if they ask them, a whole different price. So you generally want a separation from this type of stuff. But see, in this profits a misery game, these guys are not interested in transparency, honesty, safety, any of that type of stuff. Hell, after all, it's been Halliburton that has been in the forefront of quote-unquote losing large numbers of money in Iraq in the so-called reconstruction effort. Now you have a situation where there's an action that there's this guy named Alba. And Alba is, they say he's really a lobbyist, but they're playing a word game and saying that he's a consultant. Now, what this, what I'm getting to is this. It's a little article that says, former FEMA head and Halliburton lobbyist visits Louisiana for deals on September 8th. The former head of the Federal Emergencies Management Agency, FEMA, Joseph Alba, now a lobbyist for Halliburton, is in Louisiana helping his clients obtain disaster relief contracts. But Alba insists he's not in Louisiana seeking contracts for clients. Quote, "I don't do government contracts," unquote. He told the Post from Louisiana. Instead, he says he's just trying to lend my shoulder to the wheel, trying to coordinate some private sector support that the government always asks for. But that's not the same thing as seeking government contracts for clients, says Alba. Quote, "The first thing he says when he sits down with a client is, don't hire me if you're looking for a government contract," unquote. An Alba spokesperson defensively said. Now they're trying to pretend that Alba is not really a lobbyist, as I mentioned, for Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton. He's a consultant. So now they're playing a word game. And once again, this ties in to how all of these guys are profiteering all around the world off of the masses of people's misery. They're taking money out of one sector, putting it in another sector. They're collapsing regions of the world and the stability of regions of the world. And then they get into this fake rebuilding process already with their lobbyists in hand, set to engage in new contract negotiations. Is this perpetual war, perpetual destruction, perpetual misery? And within this capitalist model, perpetual profits. This just shows you how out of kilter this system is with any kind of form of human cooperative sustainability. Next, Protop goes into the hideous mindset of the order as he goes into how the merchants of death pre-bid disaster, quote-unquote, relief and rebuilding efforts.
Explain the way contracting works is the reason Halliburton has this contract to rebuild the Navy facilities, which is a $500 million contract, is under something called CONCAP. And here we're getting to very complex contracting. But basically, the military and the State Department, too, nowadays, what they do is they pre-bid things before something happens. So I'll give you an example. In Darfur, for example, there was a conflict in Darfur. 2 years before the conflict happened in Darfur, the State Department said, what if something happens somewhere in Africa? We need to be ready to move instantly and send peacekeeping forces. So we're going to pre-bid these contracts, even though we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So this is the same thing in the case of the Navy. They pre-bid contracts. So July 2004, the Navy said, what happens if we need to do some rebuilding of facilities? Let's put out a bid. And so we'll invite people who are qualified, have the right security clearances, etc., to bid for this. And then when a disaster happens, we can put them in place. So theoretically, this was competitively bid before it even happened. And that's where the government, this is how the government is doing things these days. Sometimes in the case of Darfur, what they do is they'll hire two companies and they'll say, when it comes to actually implementing this project, we'll have you compete against each other. So you have a competitive bid before anything happens and then a limited bid just before it actually occurs. And so days after Katrina happened, they gave the contract to Halliburton because Halliburton competed for this contract in July 2004. Incidentally, CONCAP is the same contract under which they went and built the prisons in Guantanamo Bay. So it's a whole mess of different kinds of contracting. There's CONCAP, there's LOGCAP, there's it gets really complex. But it's basically the same mechanism that was used to give them a contract in Guantanamo Bay is the one that they're using in Louisiana now, and different from the one in Iraq.
All right, once again, you can see how these prophets of misery seekers create a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's why, as I said, they're also the prophets of doom. They know that their system, that's basically what they're telling you, that our system perpetuates conflict, war, destruction, and those people in our same model and under our same sphere of influence perpetuate violence and mayhem. So like the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on, the cartoon government, which is in alignment with Sam, and Bashir, and you know, the other little thugs in a cartoon, were openly bragging about in the Ken Silverman article about how they're helping Sam in his quote-unquote war on terrorism, feeding them information and all of that. Now they all play that little game that there's a fight against cultures and all of that type of stuff, Islam versus Christianity and all of that. Yeah, that's this smoke and mirrors for the feeble mind, people who are silly enough to, you know, wrap themselves around you know, one embryonic tradition of illusion versus another. You know, they're all little cousins, you know, Islam, Christians, Hebrons, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, they know that in the Sudan, the cartoon government, under its Arab Islamic identity, has its disposable population, which, by the way, is quite similar to the disposable population here in America, and disposable to the ruling elite population in Haiti, and well, I think you get the point. Nevertheless, the way this order runs, there's going to be conflict and destruction, and these prophets of misery are right there in this self-fulfilling capitalist machine policy of making sure that their corporate hooves get sunk deep into the ground so that they can make their extreme forms of financial profit. Now next, Protop goes into how if you get killed working for Halliburton in Iraq, it basically comes out of the taxpayers' wallets, which is another reason why the profits of misery don't mind.
Rock, if somebody gets killed working for Halliburton, Halliburton will get the insurance company to pay, or they generally fight any kind of payouts for injured people and that sort of thing, and it's a big problem. But AIG, for example, the insurance company would pay it, but then the federal government has to repay them under what's called the Defense Base Act. Now, I know that would not be true of private homes in the United States, but in the case of somebody who is under contract with the federal government, eventually the federal government and us, the taxpayer, would have to pay.
So once again, you see this is a big setup. Now, it's interesting that, like, if you get injured, then Halliburton fights against paying for an injured person because that would come out of their pocket. So there's reports. You remember not too long ago when there was a woman in Iraq, an Iraqi woman. She was like 25. And because many of the jobs had been crushed because of the societal collapse that the imperialists have thrust in Iraq, she ended up getting a little job working for Halliburton. And she ended up getting shot and went blind when she got shot. Once she got injured, all these Halliburton clowns that were telling her she had done a good job and how much they enjoyed her and, you know, respected the fact that she could speak English fluently and all of that type of stuff, they disappeared. Just like her eyesight did. And haven't been seen since. Prophets of Misery. Now last, Protop goes into how much of a share for Halliburton. How much these shares have gone up. And who profits off of these things. And at the same time, basically, while their profits go up, so does our misery.
Gone up 50%. I have one share in Halliburton, and I bought it at $42 in March of this year, and it's now, when I checked yesterday, it was worth $62. And if you compare to 1 year ago, it has more than doubled. It was $29 a year ago today. It's now $62 is the value of my one share, which allows me to attend their shareholder meetings. I did recently attend their shareholder meeting. I presented them with an alternative annual report that I'd written, and I actually got to meet the CEO of Halliburton himself, who was very curious about CorpWatch, because I guess they've come under quite a lot of heat because of our research and critique of them.
So once again, you can see what's happening. Around this time of last year, they were around $29 a share. Now they're at $62. Now, if one is honest and looks at other industries in America, you see all types of collapses, except for those within the American empire that are based in oil, coal, military weapons building, you know, like Lockheed, you know, the Halliburton types. These are all industries that are perpetuating misery, destruction to the climate, the global climate, destruction to the human climate, destruction to human civility. These guys are the prophets of doom. I mean, it can't be any more clear. This is what they're based in. And this is what the capitalist order is based in. This is how it operates. This is not some kind of abnormal thing. None of these entities are really ostracized in this particular society. Actually, they're seen as the way to go, as part of the responsible elements. Now, at the same time, you have a situation where oil prices have now topped $70 a barrel after Hurricane Sam hit. And an article breaks down how, quote, shutdowns of oil platforms, refineries, and pipelines along the Gulf Coast drove energy prices sharply higher Tuesday. That all but guarantees a surge in pump prices in the days ahead. Light sweet crude for October delivery rose $3.50 to $70 or 70 cents a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. The buying frenzy reflected uncertainty and fear about the full extent of the damage Hurricane Sam, as we call it, inflicted on key energy infrastructures. Analysts said that even if Sam did less harm than feared, its effect would tighten the availability of already scarce refined products like heating oil and gasoline. J.P. Morgan report released Tuesday said Katrina, i.e. Sam, has already forced a production halt in about 630,000 barrels of crude a day from the Gulf of Mexico, some 12% of daily output. Now, once again, here, everyone else, I'm talking real human beings, working class human beings, they're paying a price, suffering in one degree or another, either at the gas pumps, either in some kind of a shelter, located out, dislocated out, spatially deconcentrated out in Utah or whatever. But the only people who are sitting high on the hog are the true merchants of misery, the corporate capital financial class, the profits of misery. And this is how it's set up to be. This is not some kind of abstract coincidence. It's set up for them to be profitable off of our misery, off of our exploitation, off of the planet's exploitation. Now, with what we just went over, check out how on this New Orleans TV news program on September 7th, 2005, the guest talks in his matter-of-fact way of what may have to happen to polluted waters in New Orleans and neighborhood. So check this out.
Have any idea of how long it's going to take to clean this water until they have some idea of exactly what's in the water?
Yeah, and one possibility, because all of this goes to the lake.
Right.
Now that's where it's all being pumped to right now. And there is a possibility that perhaps next spring, during the high water levels on the Mississippi River, one option would be to open the Bonnie Carey spillway, pump a river, which allows a lot of river water to flow into the lake, and basically try to flush it out, get some of this nastiness out of the lake. And then also you'd bring in some new sediment from the river that could settle on the bottom and perhaps seal off some of the stuff.
The prediction, I mean, they have known for years down the line about the water going over the levees, causing this toxic soup, even leading to some looting and things like that, the unrest afterward, and not being taken seriously by authorities that could do something.
You know, it's one of those things, Dennis, and we've done stories on it 3, 4, 5 years ago about this worst-case scenario. And even then, when we did stories and talked to people who were involved in planning for this, in some instances, there was a reluctance to even talk about it because it was just so unthinkable. And it's the kind of thing that you almost can't plan for because it is just such a massive catastrophe. And that was the feeling that you got a few years ago when you tried to discuss it with me. It was out there. It was a possibility. In talking to Ivar Van Heerden, I asked him, do you think the city can be rebuilt because of this pollution problem? He said, yeah, he believes it can be. He says, although there may be some neighborhood because of some localized heavy contamination where it may not be possible, where they may have to perhaps bring in sediment to cover up whatever's on the ground and let that area just revert to wetlands, that sort of thing. So it's there is a lot to be learned about what's going to be left in the city and what it's going to take to try to restore it in the future.
Very interesting. Thank you.
For joining us.
Once again, this makes it pretty clear on how barbaric this particular order is. If you listen to the commentator, he admitted that they had known about it for years, but there was a reluctance to talk about it. Now, one all has to do is read, in a sense, between some of these lines. Because when he's talking about how there's a reluctance to talk about it, that has to do with the fact that to really take on the particular issue of what needs to be done, you would have to take on elements of the prophets of misery, the prophets of doom. And that would, of course, be the oil industry that at that very moment was tearing up the wetlands, which helps intensify hurricanes. Because as hurricanes gather speed, if you have wetlands that are collapsing, they are able to gather more speed because the wetlands actually slow them down. With the collapse of a wetland in New Orleans the size of Manhattan taking place every year, the land dwelling people had less protection from the full thrust of the hurricane. At the same time, the levees are being built on the cheap, as I pointed out, and then they're being defunded altogether, because at the end of the day, these prophets of misery know that they can make a profit regardless of how things play itself out, because they're in control of the whole order within the world today, because it's based in a market order. Now, at the same time, the funding is taking place in part because of their imperial adventures that they're engaged in throughout the world. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that you are going to have catastrophes, and that those people who are locked within the matrix of representing or defending the order are not really going to organize to take on what the order is really representing and how it really nourishes itself, which is basically off of the blood of the planet and the people who reside within it. So the reluctance to talk about it is basically a reluctance to deal with the reality of the capitalist order. I mean, that's the real world. And then when he says that you can't plan for it, well, if you work within the matrix of the system, you know, as some kind of lobbyist, as a Democrat, as a Republican, you know, as a non-committed, you know, whatever, you know, then you're going to be in a position where you can't plan for any kind of real future for humanity, because at the end of the day, you are letting the prophets of doom make the decisions for you, and your destiny is already carved in stone, or in some cases, under 20 feet of water. I mean, that's the real world. That's what's going on. That's how these profiteers engineer things. That's how things play out within this barbaric system. Here now is how the rich Sambo businessman, Mayor Richard Nagin, says that in some ways, God blessed New Orleans. Whose God? Must be the capitalist God.
By the Gulf States, the mayor of New Orleans says some of the city's structures were actually spared.
It's not God put a hedge around certain things. St. Louis Cathedral is intact. The French Quarter is intact. Uptown, tremendous flooded, but it's basically intact. A lot of the historical assets in there make New Orleans unique. is still intact. So we can rebuild, and we can rebuild something. And this is where the president got me choked up. He said, Mr. Mayor, I got it. And we're going to make sure you get the resources to rebuild New Orleans and to shine an example for them.
All right, once again, this shows how sick these types of coons are and how, in essence, they're playing along with a master's profit, a misery game. You have a situation where this coon comes out talking about, in some ways, God bless New Orleans. The French Quarter is intact. Uptown's intact. St. Louis Cathedral. Many of these areas that make New Orleans unique. But you have the core part of the population that's been utterly dislocated and demolished from their roots. And many of their basic possessions have been thrust into oblivion. But his concept of uniqueness is not the people. It's part of the property interest that he's been indoctrinated in. I mean, this just shows how out of touch, out of touch with humanity these low lives are, and how in touch they are with the elements that write the script of how the order should operate. It just shows the viciousness and the lack of human respectability that these types of people operate under. Now, in the Wall Street Journal on Thursday, September 8th, there was an article by Christopher Cooper, and it was called Old Line Families Plot the Future. So already on the 8th, the Old Line Families are inboard. Now, we've already talked about how the other elements of the capitalist class, the corporate capitalists, merchants, Halliburton, Kellogg, Brown and Root, et cetera, do their profiteering off of war, destruction, calamity that they create and perpetuate. Now, here's another element of this ruling element. The article proceeds. On a sultry morning early this week, Ashton O'Dryer steps out of his home on this city's grandest street and made a beeline for his neighbor's pool. Wearing nothing but a pair of blue swim trunks and carrying two milk jugs, he drew enough pool water to flush the toilet in his home. The mostly African-American neighborhoods of New Orleans are largely underwater, and the people who live there have scattered all across the country. But in many of the predominantly white and more affluent areas, streets are dry and passable. Gracious homes are mostly intact and powered by generators. Wednesday, officials reiterated that all residents must leave New Orleans, but it's still unclear how far they will go to enforce the order. The green expanse of Audubon Park in the city's uptown area has doubled in recent days as a heliport for the city's rich, and a terminus for the small armies of private security guards who have been dispatched to keep the homes there safe and habitable. Mr. O'Dwyer has cell phone service and ice cubes to cool off his highballs in the evening. By Wednesday, the city water service even sprang to life, making the daily trips to his neighbor's pool unnecessary. A pair of oil company engineers dispatched by his son-in-law delivered four cases of water, a box of delicacies including herring and mustard sauce, and 15 gallons of generator gasoline. Despite the disaster that has overwhelmed New Orleans, the city's money
mostly white elite, is hanging on and maneuvering to play a role in the recovery when the floodwaters of Katrina are gone. Quote, New Orleans is ready to be rebuilt. Let's start right here, unquote, says Mr. O'Dwyer, standing in his expansive kitchen next to a counter covered with a jumble of weaponry and electric wires. More than a few people in Uptown, the fashionable district surrounding St. Charles Avenue, have ancestors who've arrived here in the 1700s. High society is still dominated by these old line families, represented today by prominent figures such as former New Orleans Board of Trade President Thomas Westfield, Richard Freeman, scion of the family that long owned the city's Coca-Cola bottling plant, and William Boltner Raleigh, owner of the Louisiana Coffee Company. Their social pecking order is dictated by the mysterious hierarchies of Cruz groups with heredity membership that participated in the annual carnival leading up to the Mardi Gras. In recent years, the city's most powerful business circles have expanded to include some newcomers and non-whites, such as Mayor Ray Nagin, the former Cox communication executive elected in 2002. A few blocks from Mr. O'Dwyer is an exclusive gated community known as Audubon Palace, in the home of James Reyes, descendant of an old line uptown family. He fled Hurricane Katrina just before the storm and returned soon afterwards by private helicopter. Mr. Reyes became wealthy as a supplier of electronic systems to shipbuilders, and he serves in Mayor Nagin's administration as chairman of the city's regional transit authority. When New Orleans descended into a spiral of looting and anarchy, quote unquote, Mr. Reyes helicoptered in an Israeli security company to guard his Audubon Palace house and those of his neighbors. He says he has been in contact with about 40 other New Orleans business leaders since the storm. Tomorrow, he says, he and some of those leaders plan to be in Dallas meeting with Mr. Nagin to begin mapping out the future for the city. The power elites of New Orleans, whether they are still in the city or have moved temporarily to enclaves such as Florida or Colorado, insist the remade city won't simply restore the old order. New Orleans before the flood was burdened by teeming underclass, substandard schools, and a high crime rate. The city has few corporate headquarters. The new city must be something very different, Mr. Reyes said, with better services and fewer poor people. Quote, those who want to see the city rebuilt want to see it done in a completely different way, demographically, geographically, and politically. Unquote, he says. I'm not just speaking for myself here. The way we've been living is not going to happen again, or we're out. Unquote. Not every white business leader of prominent family supports that view. Some black leaders and their allies in New Orleans fear that it boils down to preventing large numbers of blacks from returning to the city and eliminating the African-American voting majority. Republican William Jefferson, a sharecropper's son who was educated at Harvard and is currently living in his eighth term in Congress, points out that the evacuees from New Orleans already have been spread out across many states far from their old home and won't be able to afford to return. Quote, this is an example of poor people forced to make decisions because they don't have the money to do otherwise, unquote, Mr. Jefferson says. Now, once again, here you have these prophets of misery outlining the destiny of this particular city. And it's a city that they don't plan on a large majority of the people having a say in. As a matter of fact, their say is of no value to them, because the avenue of where they come from is part of an economic capital moneyed order that does not value the basic lives of the masses of people. They're expendable, as we saw in Hurricane Sam, and how they were allowed to perish in all kinds of barbaric ways. And in this particular order, they're allowed and will be sent to perish somewhere else on Sam's plantation. All of this talk of rebuilding and stuff like that, look, New Orleans and all of these particular regions have been steeped in slavery, Jim Crowism, and other forms of barbarity. Now these fools have the nerve to talk about a class, quote unquote, people lacking some kind of moral ethics when they are part of the slaveocracy class in the real world. Now this also helps show that Nagin and all of these types of Negroes are basically part of the class of Negroes that work in cooperation of the order as long as they can get theirs. In other words, they side with the imperialist order. They're no more than, you know, just like Mobutu or Savimbi or, you know, those types of individuals. They side with the ruling capital order, often because they believe in the capitalist model themselves or have a higher interest towards profits than the worth and respect for human beings, even if those human beings look like them. So you see this go on with Charles Taylor and company and, you know, and on down the long, dreary line. Now, in part, the reason why I mention this is that you're going to hear these prophets of doom makers and these spin masters try to say that this wasn't racialized because, after all, many of the people who were involved in the administration in New Orleans were black. And why would they just let fellow black people, be pulverized? So, Burax, he's another one. He's a senator, a former senator, John Burax. He got together with all these Louisiana congressional members and engineers, urban planners, and all of that type of stuff to, of course, talk about the rebuilding of Iraq. And, of course, he put out the same talking points memo that you've heard Boy George say, and that you heard that Scott McCullen clown, who I blew up in the beginning of the show, say that they don't want to be part of the quote-unquote blame game. and he goes into how the blame does not save lives, feed families, or compensate loss. Now, in reality, it's not really about a blame game. This is about exposing their complicity in destroying families, destroying the basic human rights of people having the ability to feed themselves, etc., etc. So, these are just talking point games that these little lowlives like to get into. But he was asked about Burax, I'm saying, about how it was more or less the idea that food, water, and supplies were slow to reach those stranded at the Superdome and a convention center because of racial motivations. Burak's response was, quote, "Mayor Ray Nagin is an African-American. Almost the entire New Orleans City Council is made up of African-Americans. To suggest that these African-American leaders would shortchange their own citizens is a suggestion that is absolutely without merit," quote unquote. Now the reason why I mention this within the context is I just outlined within that Wall Street Journal article how Nagin is part and has aligned himself a part of that old line family elite. And that old line family elite is outwardly talking about, we can't have a New Orleans like that of the past. you know, with the poor and all of that type of stuff. We have to make a new New Orleans, knowing that that has racial implications. And at the same time that they're talking this type of stuff, you have various people within the order, like Boy George, setting up policies to perpetuate people being locked into poverty. Like the way that Boy George has recently, under this emergency relief type thing, slashed the David Bacon Act, which undermines the prevailing wage and underlines unions. So jobs that many working class people could have gotten and used as a way of developing a trade or skill, or expanding their trade or skill if they already have them in that particular region, they would be forced to take those jobs at subhuman wages, thus be grinding like hell in the region to rebuild it, only to be mired in the super poverty. And the only one who gets off like fat cats are, guess who? The corporate class, the profits and misery. So when Burak talks all this stuff, you know, spewing stuff out of his behind about how, you know, these large African Americans, and they wouldn't do it to African, you know, they wouldn't subject their own people. It's ludicrous to think that way. When you have the Charles Taylors, which Nagin is a part of, he's part of the Charles Taylor, who aligns themselves with ruling orders and capitalist-minded enterprises and people to helps them exploit his own people to his expense, you know, for his expansion. You know, Savimbi, Mobutu, they're part of that. Now, here's Mike Howe talking about, as we wrap this aspect of it up. Here's Mike Howe. He's someone who is a resident of New Orleans, and he's talking about the another form or color of looting, regular type of looting that you generally see on TV, but you really didn't see this type of common blue collar form of looting take place on TV in this New Orleans adventure, partly because it was colored the wrong way.
Store I'm standing in front of is Circle K. It's a local mini market, like Stop and Go. And I used to go to this store every morning for coffee, cigarettes, iced tea, whatever I wanted, Angela wanted. And I think the history of this store, as far as looting goes, pretty much reflects the history of looting recently in New Orleans. When I saw people looting this store, and I saw people repeatedly looting for 5 days straight, this store was open for, maybe not for business, but open for shopping. And people would come in and take out whatever they were going to take out. But what I noticed here is that the vast majority of people looting this store were white and middle class, okay? And I saw this one woman take goods out of here, and she was definitely, lives in a house, a property owner, obviously fairly well-to-do, about 70, had a very much the patrician air about her. And she had been hostile to street entertainers prior to the hurricane. I'm a street, as I mentioned, street entertainer. And so she'd always been kind of a law and order person, so to speak. But now I noticed that she was walking outside this store with looted goods. And I walked up to her and just have a little fun. And I said, isn't it illegal to take those products? And she said, well, I earned them and I'm going to keep them. This was a woman who used to complain about the homeless, the tarot card readers, the street musicians, the young blacks running around. Now she went back to her $500,000 home with her looted goods. Okay. On another occasion, fellow we know, an associate. He's a retired surgeon. He looks just like Alfred Hitchcock and Irving. And when we saw him coming out of the store, he turned and looked at us. He said, "I never dreamed I would be a looter, but now I'm a looter." So just imagine Alfred Hitchcock looting your local Stop and Go or Mini Mart. That's what you have.
So this is not the type of stuff you saw on TV, because it doesn't fit the type of mentality of the whole profit and self-righteousness that is part of a cornerstone within the fabric of the market system, with its racialized hierarchy, dwells right within it. The images of these within Halliburton and those within the old line moneyed family, and then those who were doing this good old-fashioned blue-collar looting, takes place all within the sphere of a privileged sector that feels that it is above reproach. They can loot the planet. They can loot other people. They can decide who lives and don't live. They can decide who is able to stay in a region and who can't. All for their profits, regardless of our misery. And because of the way systematic white supremacy is played within this society, they don't expect to be called out on it. Even when their profits and misery philosophy has boatloads of stranded young and old people starving and dying because of ill treatment and lack of medication in a superdome and beyond. Just another element of the construct within America and within the machine of America, of the prophets of misery, these prophets of doom. Hold on.
Out of the water, but the water was coming in too fast. So we ended up having to leave the house. We left the house and we went up on the roof of the school. I took a crowbar and I burst the door open on the roof of the school to help people, to get them up onto the roof of the school. Later on, we found a flatboat. And we went around in the neighborhood in a flatboat, getting people out of their houses and bringing them to the school. We found all the food that we could, and we cooked and we fed people. So then, things started getting really bad. By the second day, the people that were there, that we were feeding and everything, we had no more food, no water. We had nothing. And other people were coming into our neighborhood. We were watching the helicopters go across the bridge and airlift other people up, but they would hover over us and tell us, hi. And that would be all. They wouldn't drop us any food, any water, nothing. Alligators were eating people. They had all kinds of stuff in the water. They had babies floating in the water. We had to get all hundreds of bodies of dead people. People that we tried to save from the hospitals and from the old folks home. I tried to get the police campus, but I realized we rescued a lot of police officers in the flatboat from the district police station. The guy who was driving the boat, he rescued a lot of them and brought them to different places where they could be safe. We understood that the police couldn't help us, but we couldn't understand why the National Guard and them couldn't help us, because we kept seeing them, but they never would stop and help us. Finally, it got me too much. I just took all of the people that I could. I had two old women in wheelchairs with no legs, that I rode them from down there in that night ward to the front court, and I went back and I got more people. There were groups of us. You know, there was about 24 of us, and we kept going back and forth and rescuing whoever we could get and bringing them to the French Quarter, because we heard that there were phones in the French Quarter and that there wasn't any water. And they were right, there were phones, but we couldn't get to the phones. I found some police officers. I told them that a lot of us women had been raped down there by guys who had come from the neighborhood where we were, that were helping us to save people. But other men, and they came and they started raping women, and they started killing. And I don't know who these people were. I'm not going to tell you. I know who they were. Because I don't. But what I want people to understand is that if we had not been left down there like the animals that they were treating us like, all of those things wouldn't have happened. People are trying to say that we stayed next to this because we wanted to be rioted and we wanted to do this. And we didn't have resources to get out. We had no way to leave. When they gave the evacuation order, if we could have left, we would have left. There are still thousands and thousands of people trapped in the homes down in the downtown area. When we finally did get to town in the Ninth Ward, and not just in my neighborhood, but in other neighborhoods in the Ninth Ward, there are a lot of people who are still trapped down here. Old people, young people, babies, pregnant women. I mean, nobody's helping us. And I want people to realize that we did not stay in that city so that we could steal and loot and commit crime. A lot of those young men lost their minds because the helicopters would fly over and they wouldn't stop. They'd do SOS on the flashlight, like this and everything. And it came to a point, it really did come to a point where these young men were so frustrated that they did start shooting. They weren't trying to hit the helicopters. They figured maybe they weren't seeing. Maybe if they hear this gunfire, they would stop then. But that didn't help us. Nothing like that helped us. Finally, I got to Canal Street with all of my people that I had saved from back there. There was a whole group of us. I don't want them arresting nobody else. I broke the window in an RTA bus. I never learned how to drive a bus in my life. I got in that bus. I loaded all of those people in wheelchairs and in everything else into that bus. And we drove. We drove. And millions of people was trying to get me to help them to get on the bus with me.
Which was in 1994 when Robertson bilked Operation Blessing donors out of money for to ferry mining equipment into Zaire, which was a direct partnership with Mobutu Sese Seko. This scheme was actually exposed by a reporter from a small paper in Virginia, and the Virginia's Office of Consumer Affairs initiated an investigation and determined that Robertson willfully induced contributions from the public through the use of misleading statements and other implications. That's a direct quote. So they determined that he bilked his donors, and the attorney general at the time, a guy named Mark Early, agreed. But he overruled the Office of Consumer Affairs recommendation for Robertson's criminal prosecution. This might have put Robertson in jail and ended his entire ministry. So who is Mark Early? Mark Early, during his campaign for attorney general, was essentially bought off by Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson donated $35,000 to his campaign. That was his largest contribution. Now, today, Mark Early is the head of Prison Fellowship Ministries. He was appointed by former Richard Nixon dirty trickster Chuck Colson. And Prison Fellowship Ministries is very similar to Operation Blessing. They're a faith-based social work group that has accepted White House Office of Faith-Based Initiative money to do social work, and they're actually supposedly doing some relief work in Louisiana. So I think this reflects, sort of the larger hustle going on, which is being propagated by the White House. In 2001, Joe Alba, who is a former member of Bush's Iron Triangle, with Karen Hughes and Karl Rove, his Texas team, was appointed head of FEMA, and he said before Congress that FEMA was a giant bureaucratic entitlement program, and that it should basically be whittled down, and its work should be delegated to faith-based organizations. So we're seeing that being implemented through his successor, Mike Brown, who is his former college roommate and was appointed FEMA head solely because he was Joe Alba's former college roommate. So we're seeing groups like, I mean, there were only two secular groups on FEMA's list. And currently, I think there are scores of secular groups doing relief work. Pat Robertson's group, Operation Blessing, is not doing relief work in Louisiana. They, I turned on the 700 Club, which is Pat Robertson's daily TV show, where he called for Hugo Chavez's assassination to get a sense of the kind of work they were doing. And what I saw were profiles of white evangelicals who had suffered as a result of Hurricane Katrina. And undoubtedly, a lot of white evangelicals in the Gulf Coast of Mississippi have suffered. But when it came to covering the plight of people in New Orleans who are largely poor and largely black, I haven't witnessed any coverage of this disaster that's so racist as I saw on the 700 Club. On the September 5th edition of the 700 Club, there was a report from a guy named Gary Lane, a CBN correspondent from outside the New Orleans Convention Center, which is where thousands of impoverished disaster victims were held without food and water for some days in some cases. And Lane declared, a number of possessions left behind suggest the mindset of some of the evacuees. They include this voodoo cup with the saying, "May the curse be with you," and then a picture of a voodoo cup from like a souvenir shop in New Orleans came on the screen. Then he started showing piles of music CDs. It reminded me of when the U.S. Invaded Panama and opened up Manuel Noriega's desk and found, porno magazines. It was almost like a psyops operation to discredit the evacuees as people not worthy of aid. And the 700 Club also featured a reverend named Wellington Boone, who's a far right-wing black minister who seemed like he was invited to provide a counterpoint to Jesse Jackson, who'd been all over the news. And Boone declared in an interview on CBN's website, separate from his 700 Club appearance, that these people who have gone through slavery, segregation, and the Voting Rights Act are doing this to themselves. So what I saw in Pat Robertson's operation was an intentional attempt to demonize the people who had been victimized by Hurricane Katrina and by the response of the government in order to justify whatever his operation was doing on the ground, which seemed to be directed at helping only a certain subset of the hurricane victims, which were in his ministry's network, as it were. And, when I say network, I mean within the network of the churches who he's distributing cash grants to.
There you have it. All elements of the order. From the corporate, capitalist, to the military, to the financial institutions, to the old line money, to the charity, quote-unquote, reliefs, like Robinson. They're all part of the profits of misery model. They are the profits of doom. And those that align themselves, these pathetic Negroes, whether it's a Jesse Jackson in the Democratic Party, or a Nagin aligning himself with the old line in New Orleans, or Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, who had 10% stock in Robinson's company, the fact that they are black doesn't mean that they do not align themselves with the order that crushes blacks. They're part of the mechanism of the profits of misery and the profits of doom. What we have to say to all of those elements and do to them is make sure it's clear that it's the end of the line. Until the next time, slave revolt.
This is the